Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals to do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. This week, we spoke with Ryan Anthony, a Dallas Symphony Orchestra principal trumpet player who was diagnosed with multiple myeloma at the age of 43 after experiencing chronic aches and pains from playing his instrument.
To start, can you just tell us a little bit about your cancer journey, maybe like what led to your diagnosis?
Actually what led me to going to the doctor was playing the trumpet, and I was just getting a bunch of pains in my ribs when I would take deep breaths and play. And it was, first it was just very seldom, and then it became more and more, and we found high calcium. I went to the doctor and they couldn't figure anything out, so finally we went to a endocrinologist, and they weren't going to even test for myeloma because I said I wasn't even a candidate for it. But sort of insisted just so we can make sure there wasn't any cancer, and it came back positive. We got a call 2 days later, and then so 2 days after that, we were in the oncologist getting looked at and getting a bone marrow biopsy, and it was over 80% cancer cells. So, but once we started that process, I mean, it took about a week for us to get it diagnosed. It was the trumpet that took me in.
Okay. And so you were diagnosed with a cancer type that typically occurs in older adults. What kind of ran through
Correct.
Your head when you were actually diagnosed at the age of 43, right?
Yeah, I was 43 at the time. We knew of the cancer, and so we knew at that point, and we had investigated into it and knew the severity of it, and that there was no cure. And then as we kept getting more and more tests, it started showing more of what they're called high risk with particular gene deletions. So it was sort of, you know, they said it was a small minority that would even get it in their 40s, and then within that there was a small risk of those who were high risk, and we had that, and those of the high risk, it was a small percentage who would have the particular gene deletions, and I had that. So it was, we kept winning the lottery, but in the wrong way. So it was a very difficult thing to process. And our children at the time were quite a bit younger. I think they were in eighth grade and fifth grade. And so we went to several different places to be looked at to get opinions. And the specialists varied everywhere from 1 to 2 years of life to, some said maybe 5. And then here at Baylor with Dr. Behrman, he thought that he can stretch it out to 10 years. And so this was the only place that really had gave the hope of thinking that we can find a way to stretch this out. But otherwise, I was basically told to get 2-3 years and maybe 5 at max. So that was a hard thing to process when you have, you know, children and lots of dreams and aspirations to do with your family.
Absolutely. And so speaking of your children, how did you actually go on to have that discussion with them when it came to your diagnosis?
Well, the first thing we did is we asked them not to get online, because everything that was on there was years old and really not up to date, and they didn't need to be reading that their father was going to die within a year or two. And so we put it as, instead of saying terminal, we told them it was treatable, and that I was just going to have to be treated for the rest of my life, and that there are going to be times when I'm going to be sicker than other times, but that it was a treatable thing, and that we just had to have a lifestyle change, and that they had to be, you know, aware of that. And they, they took it pretty well. I mean, I think our son was just so young, he just thought, okay, it's like I'll get the flu every once in a while. You know, he just didn't really quite process the severity of it. And we even took them to the clinic sometimes with us, you know, so that they can see what was going on. So I think their imagination sometimes is a lot worse than reality. And so they were involved through it the whole way. We just kept telling them that it was a treatable thing and that I'm going to be sick off and on, but we'll always treat it, and I'll be, you know, so that was the way we approached it at the beginning.
Okay. And do you have any advice, kind of now that you can look back on how you told them, do you have any advice for other parents that maybe have to also have this conversation?
Yeah, I think, looking back, I mean, we knew we had to say something, because suddenly, I mean, we were, you know, our lives had turned upside down. I was in and out of the clinic and the hospital. We were having late night meetings with our friends who were doctors doing research. So I know they were trying to be curious to see what was going on, you know, keep getting phone calls and step outside. And, you know, I think the kids are, they're more aware and smarter than we give them credit for. So we decided that, in some ways the best thing to do is to keep them involved, and let them know what was going on. But, you know, we painted that picture that it's going to be a long road, but it's, you know, it's a treatable, thing and cancer. And we're just going to, have to have a, you know, lifestyle change, but we're going to do it together. And, you know, they seem to take that and be okay with it. I think as much as I can, you know, and then we talked to the school counselors, of course, and gave them an out. So they always had someone that they can go talk to when they just had days that, you know, they were a little too stressed out about. So I think that's, you know, our thing is that we look back, we're glad we brought them in and made them a part of the journey. And we've done that throughout the whole time. And this past year was difficult because we had so many relapses, and in January we were actually told 6 to 12 months, 1 to 2 years. And so we once again we had to have that discussion with our children. Of course now they're 17 and 13. And that was probably the hardest thing I ever had to do. But again, they kind of knew something was up. And so we, our 17-year-old asked us that she wanted to know everything, because otherwise her imagination was worse. So we've always tried to keep them, and we told them it's going to be the family has to be together, and that I need the strength from the whole family to get through this. And so in some ways it's just sort of been, that's just been life, and we just go forward with it, and that's just what they know.
Okay. And so, can you briefly just describe what your path of treatment has been since your diagnosis?
Yeah. There's been basically 3 transplants in the last 10 months, and the last 2 years has been just a constant change of going through all the medications that have been out there. So we went through the second generation, third generations of all the drugs. And what we're trying to do now is buy some time. There are 2 drugs that are out there waiting to be FDA approved. And so the idea is that this last boost of cells will give me the time until these 2 new drugs are out there. And then hopefully those will work.
And, you know, speaking of all the different drugs that you were on, you know, it wasn't too long ago, 10 plus years ago, that there was, you know, only a handful of drugs approved, if that.
Right.
We've had, you know, 10 in the last 10 years or something along those lines.
Right.
How would you say that these recent advances have kind of changed the myeloma space?
I mean, it's completely turned it around, because now I really don't think it's viewed, even with high-risk patients like myself, as a terminal. I mean, we're able to really sort of say it's a treatable disease. I mean, you know, and ultimately that's what we're trying to do, is to make it something that's livable, like diabetes or HIV or something like that. Which, so they know that there's so many things out there. We started our foundation 5 years ago to help with cancer research. So we actually work very closely with the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation and with them, some pharmaceutical companies trying to help, do whatever we can to raise awareness with our foundation and funds. And so, just to see, to know, there's been 10 new things, drugs in the last few years since I've been diagnosed. There's been a handful. I mean, I've been on drugs that weren't even available when I was, diagnosed almost 7 years ago. And then now there's two more. And you got to think about then what's going to be happening the year after that. So there's always something on the horizon. And if there's anything I've learned, I mean, the biggest drug to beat cancer is hope. And, without that, then it's self-defeating. But to have hope and know that there's all these new drugs that came out in the last 10 years, and there's a handful that are going to be coming out in the next few years. And looking at what's going on with CAR T and all these new things that are happening, it's very encouraging. And what used to be a complete death sentence with myeloma is now something that can be treated. And we always tell everybody, it's not the myeloma that kills you; it's the multiple part. And it used to be there was just one treatment, and it didn't matter what subset you were. And now they can, they can split it up and so many different subsets for each patient, and be able to diagnose and give them the best thing for them. And, that's totally changed the treatment and the pathway for myeloma patients.
Absolutely. And so I know you had mentioned your foundation, but before we get into that, can you just go into a little bit about how music played a role in your cancer journey, and why maybe it's important for patients to find similar outlets when it comes to kind of dealing with this hard time?
Yeah, I mean, not only did it obviously bring me into the doctor earlier than I probably would have, but exactly what you said, it was an outlet. For me, I continued working full time with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra every week. We would do four concerts a week, and often on Fridays I would get my Velcade and then I'd go and play a concert. And I did that for years, actually up until this past season. I think I only missed one concert in five years with the orchestra. And part of that was because I just didn't want the cancer to define who I was. I mean, what I did for a living is I played trumpet and with the orchestra, and I wasn't going to allow that to be taken away because that was my passion. Cancer can take so many things away. I just didn't. It was important to me that my outlet and my passion, whether it be a hobby or, in my case, my professional job, that that was something the cancer just couldn't take away. So it was a great outlet on many nights. I mean, there was difficult times playing. I had wonderful colleagues and management that supported me, and they understood there was going to be difficult weeks, and they allowed me to have those, but they knew it was important for me to show up there every night. And I really can't imagine during especially during the year when we were going through the drugs so quickly, and it was so easy to get mentally and physically just exhausted and depressed and pushed down. But every night I got to play music. It was an outlet, and hear the audience applaud. And, and so they don't care. They had no idea, whether I have cancer or not. They just know that they're moved by something that I was able to do. So despite the cancer, there was still something always good that I felt I was involved in and making a difference to those who wanted to come to the concert. So it was kind of twofold in that sense. I mean, it was a good outlet for me. And then it also gave me that that kind of that feeling of I'm still relevant. You know, I'm still able to do something that makes a difference to others. And I think that's important for so many cancer patients to, for that, you know, not to find themselves alone, but to feel like they're still involved in the community and making a difference in other lives, and at the same time to get involved with something that they're passionate about, that they can have an outlet. Because, I mean, there was just some nights I needed that, and that was the only way I could find a way to express myself.
And so with that, can you just discuss the Ryan Anthony Foundation and Cancer Blitz and kind of how they came about and what their missions are?
Yeah, it came about with my first transplant in 2013. I was amazed and touched at how many people reached out to me, you know, giving me good wishes, and, you know, and it was, you know, very touching. People were calling me all around the country and saying that they had heard. But it was actually the week prior to my transplant, Doc Severinsen had called me, which, of course, is, for me as a child, was a huge sort of idol of mine. And we had met several years ago and created a friendship. And so while we were talking, he just said he wished there was something he could do. And I just said, well, promise me that when I get through this, we can share the stage together again. And he said, well, of course. And so that just sort of became my battle cry to everybody who called me. And they asked, you know, is there something I can do for you? And I said, just promise me that when we get through this, that, you know, share the stage again with me. And so, you know, and of course, everybody said yes. And I just figured they were being nice, giving me sort of that dangling carrot in front of me to help me get through the transplant. You know, we didn't know what that was going to be. You know, we're still in the back of our minds having some of these specialists say, you've got a year, you know, or 2 years. And so I just started saying that to everybody. And after the transplant, I mean, actually, you know, lying in bed, and I thought, wow, you know, it really would be amazing if, of course, it'll never happen, if all these players could actually be together. And, you know, just, it would be an impossible thing with their schedules. And I said, but wouldn't it be nice if we can do a concert and do like a fundraising thing? And my wife laughed and said, yeah, you can call it Cancer Blows. And you know, we chuckled, and the next day I thought, wait a minute, that's brilliant. So we got through it, and before I could even say anything, all the artists told me, and they said, okay, well, when are we doing this? They were serious about it. So they actually demanded it. You know, they said, we did a promise, let's do it. And we actually found a date. So we had about 25 of the biggest name trumpet players in the country all come in together. The Dallas Symphony Orchestra went in and donated their services, and we just did a big gala type concert. We thought it would just be a one-off, but in order for us to really take the funds and be able to do something with them, we applied for the 501c3 status and created the foundation so we could then turn around and give the money to research. So we did the concert. It was a huge success. We made the CD and DVD of it, and every artist afterwards said, well, when's the next one? And we laughed, and they all wanted to do it again. And then we just started getting lots of calls and emails from people all around the country, because we streamed it about a month afterwards, and asking when's the next one, and what a difference it had made in their personal life and journey. We did a song called Song of Hope, and we had several people that said they would watch that every night, and when it started giving up, and now their numbers were getting back together, you know, we're starting to come back up. So that, to me, was another showing the power of music. And so non-musicians started asking us, you know, can we do another one? And so next thing you know, we started planning another one, and it's now we're going on our fifth year, and it's a full-time year-round foundation. I've heard so many different things from different patients, but you know, the biggest thing that seems to be people are just amazed to think about how many artists are willing to sacrifice their time on our behalf. You know, I mean, they don't know us, but they believe in music and that it's going to make a difference, and they're willing to donate their talents and their gifts. And I think that says a lot, that it's, you know, our fight is much bigger than just us. You know, so often we think it's just the cancer patients and the caretakers, but there really are amazing people out there. And so that's been, for me, one of the biggest things, and it just provides a huge sense of hope. That's what I just keep hearing from those who write in, you know, that they... you know, they're not musicians, but they were just online and found these YouTube things, and it's changed their perspective to hear these tunes and see these artists, you know, that they're fans of, or and to see that what they're willing to do for us. So that's certainly been the biggest thing I've taken away from it. These are, you know, wonderful people, and I'm not alone.
Definitely. And so one way that I like to wrap up all of my interviews is just ask, what would you say is your biggest piece of advice for another person who's facing a cancer diagnosis?
I would really urge those to, you know, let as many people live the life with us. You know, I mean, it's doesn't just have to be the caretaker. You know, let your friends and your colleagues and everybody know. You know, it shouldn't be this disease that's quietly whispered in the corner anymore. I mean, it needs to be, the only way we're going to fix it is for everybody to get behind it.
For more information, visit cancerblows.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer Podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.